Hey guys, thank you so much for joining me on another episode of the Thoughtful Discuss podcast. The Thoughtful Discuss podcast is the home for avowed centrism and sober analysis, where thesis and antithesis are heard equally in an attempt to form a reasonable synthesis. Join me here for a sensible take on our increasingly polarized public discourse. Okay guys, today we are talking about Kamala Harris. We are talking about the pros and cons, making the case for her, and knocking it down. So I want to start here by first talking about the events that have preceded this, because some people say that this is a completely unprecedented situation, and in a large part it is. Certainly Joe Biden's decision to leave the race this late is completely without parallel. When Lyndon B. Johnson did the same thing, there was way longer before the actual election. But the story of an elitist faction of the Democratic Party sort of butting certain candidates out and putting new ones in truly is nothing new. And what I want to do is just take a quick look back here and show you guys what maybe put us here. If you remember back to the 2020 election, for example, there was a moment where Kamala Harris was not necessarily gaining steam. She always sat at around a 2% approval rating. But the guy who was winning all of the approval of the Democratic Party and had won the first three primaries was Bernie Sanders. And you will recall, suddenly all of the other candidates that were like Bernie Sanders dropped out. And soon after that, Bernie Sanders himself dropped out, and Biden was ultimately the victor. And if you believe the stories from people like Donna Brazile, they will tell you that serious elites, like people like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, made it so Bernie couldn't get to the finish line, even though he was the front runner. Now, why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because those same elites just turned on Joe Biden and basically said, we're cutting off all of the support to you if you do not stand down here. And Kamala Harris, who was never the favorite in any of these elections, like I said, she had a 2% approval rating and she dropped out before Iowa in 2020. She was very unpopular. She got completely pantsed by Tulsi Gabbard in that one selection of that first debate, or I think it was the second debate, where she basically said you put 1,500 nonviolent marijuana offenders away and you laughed about it later. Well, she's now at the top of the ticket. And what actually is reality here is that in 2020, neither of these two candidates, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, neither of them were the actual favorites of the voting sector of the party. This has been a profoundly undemocratic process. And I'm pointing this out for a simple fact. I'm not trying to attack Democrats here. I just want to point out a dynamic of this election that is manifestly true. There's an old saying about Democrats and Republicans that says that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. It's the opposite in this election. Democrats have completely fallen in line. They took their orders from above and then they decided to get behind Harris. Donald Trump is loved by the Republican Party for the most part. He is among the people who do like him, they love him. They are in love with him. They think he is going to save them. Looking past some of that smoke, though, there's another interpretation of what happened in 2020, which was that some of these elites realized that a far-left candidate really wasn't going to be able to beat Donald Trump, and that that wasn't what the country needed, and they needed the old white man who was going to be the stable hand on the wheel to get centrists and moderate voters. Now, if it's really the case that they've changed their mind here, first of all, that is interesting. And that will be something that we will have to speculate on in the time coming. Perhaps it is understood now that some of these policies that were thought originally to be very unpopular might be coming more into fashion. I'm looking at you, universal basic income. But it's also possible that this was a knee-jerk response to a very, very difficult situation that somehow people did not see coming. So let's just get to the bullet points on Kamala Harris. She was born in Oakland, California, graduated from Howard University and the University of California, Hastings College of Law. She begins her career in the office of the District Attorney of Alameda County. She's eventually recruited to the San Francisco DA's office, and she makes her name as a pretty tough prosecutor. She is the second African-American woman and the first Indian-American to serve in the U.S. Senate, where she eventually ends up. Now, as a senator, she advocated for very strict gun control laws, the DREAM Act, the federal legalization of cannabis, as well as healthcare and taxation reform, some of the post-Obama kind of initiatives. She gained a national profile for her pointed questioning of a lot of people in the Trump administration, including a very famous interaction with Brett Kavanaugh. I'm going to just admit this right here. I'm having a hard time strongmanning the case for Kamala. I did all the research for this podcast. I looked at a number of different angles. I think one of the things that is working against that strongmanning, that positive light for Kamala Harris, is that there's just not a lot of history of her executive policy, which is interesting because Donald Trump really only made any sort of entrance onto the political main stage in 2016. He had talked about running as a Democrat before and had thrown out some loose ideas about what a Trump presidency would look like, but they're actually in some ways both relative newcomers to the higher levels of executive power in the country. Now, Kamala Harris as a district attorney had a very, very tough on crime policy that actually made her probably less durable in the 2020 presidential primaries between Democrats. Now, what's interesting about that, and I have to point this out because it's, this thing becomes such an echo chamber and people really easily forget history, but Joe Biden has a very long history of being tough on drug criminals. Joe Biden had all kinds of ideas in the 80s in the drug war about putting people into jail for 5 years for like a quarter's worth of crack, and even once proposed the death penalty for drug dealers who could be connected to any sort of murder. This is actually just a skeleton in the Democrats' closet. This is something that continually comes back to haunt them, which is why when Barack Obama came onto the scene and he had only been in the Senate for 2 years, there was not this backlog of policy that could be picked upon. Whereas Joe Biden, by the time he gets to be running for his, I think, his third presidential race in 2020, he's been in government for 45, 50 years. And by the way, the infrastructure that exists around Joe Biden and that is with him right now, some of them have been with him since he was just a little older than my age, his first, maybe his second Senate campaign. So we should also understand that a lot of this stuff that is enshrined in policy and doctrine has, there's been a lot of movement in the Democratic Party on these things, and I would guess there's going to be a lot of movement now in the future, especially on stuff like marijuana legislation, which is an issue that among a lot of Democrats is just manifestly that marijuana should just be perfectly legal and we shouldn't be prosecuting people for nonviolent drug offenses. Count me in as believing that too. In the positive columns, Kamala Harris can say that as a district attorney, she did make significant progress in the violent crime department, where she had something like an 87% conviction rate for homicides and a 90% conviction rate for all felony gun violations. If Republicans are going to make the case that she was ineffective at this job, that's just not true. She was effective at that job. There are indeed some interesting cases on her record. For example, in early 2006, Gwen Arujo, a 17-year-old American Latina transgender teenager, was murdered by two men who later used the gay panic defense, which was not a defense that I was aware of, before being convicted of second-degree murder. She, alongside the mother, convened a two-day conference of at least 200 prosecutors and law enforcement officials nationwide to discuss strategies to counter such legal offenses. Now, she eventually supported AB 1160, the Gwen Arujo Justice for Victims Act, advocating that California's penal code include jury instructions to ignore bias, sympathy, prejudice, or public opinion in making their decision. And in September 2006, California governor at the time, Arnold Schwarzenegger, signed AB 1160 into a law, and the law put California on record as declaring it contrary to public policy for defendants to be acquitted or convicted of a lesser included offense on the basis of appeals to societal bias, which, to be honest, is a great calling card for the Democrats right now. She can actually make the case that she fought for a innocent transgender teenager who was murdered in cold blood, seemingly. And then when she makes it into the Senate, it's just a, you know, it's right around the time that Donald Trump starts serving his first term. And a lot of the noise she makes in her Senate, in her Senate term, is just railing against everything Donald Trump does. She described Executive Order 13769, which barred citizens from several Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S. as a Muslim ban. She voted against bringing Neil Gorsuch onto the Supreme Court, which was a pretty standard policy, or, you know, a pretty standard opinion from people, especially that were on the side of the aisle that she was. There were times where she garnered attention for her questioning of Rod Rosenstein, who was the Deputy Attorney General. And it was, these were questions over the role he played in the 2017 firing of James Comey. If you remember, James Comey came out a couple days before the 2016 election with all this kind of damning statements about Hillary Clinton. But again, nothing heroic here, nothing novel about this. This was really just party politics for the most part. Now, there are not that many bills that Kamala Harris really has signature, she can claim as signature legislation. That's about as far as I can go with the positives. And a lot of them have more to do with her pre-Senate career, to be honest. I think she can make a case as a sort of scion, more of Barack Obama than Joe Biden, because a lot of her rhetoric is tethered towards the LGBTQ community. And if there is a dichotomy in our discussion between oppressor and oppressed in our public dialogue, she is certainly the voice, or she attempts to be the voice of the oppressed, if you buy into that. Count me in as not buying into that at all. I think things are way more complicated than that. The stuff working against Kamala Harris is pretty massive at this point. I'm going to start with her earlier career. You know, there's some personal scandals that I don't think are super important. She did sleep with someone to get ahead. And, you know, I don't think that that stuff is super important in this election, especially at least since she is in an election with Donald Trump, who arguably slept with people to get behind, like literally would sleep with people, even though he knew it was going to bite him in the ass and potentially ruin his potential political prospects, I'm sure, at a number of times. There is that. It's not important to understanding her policies at all, and I don't think that it's something that we should take a lot of time on. She's on the record saying a number of things that are going to prove very controversial. One of them is this idea that there should be a buyback of the legal guns in the country, about 10 million she wants, a legal and mandatory buyback of these guns. That ain't going to sell. That's one thing. She's talked about abolishing private health care and making Medicare for all. Also, you know, a very Bernie Sanders position. And I think that this is what makes it interesting that the elite, if that is what is happening, are lining up behind here. Notable holdouts, including Barack Obama in this case, might see the fact that she or the party could benefit from some kind of open convention. But at the time of the recording of this podcast, it really does seem like she is the presumptive nominee. She also implied once that Joe Biden might be a rapist before she became his running mate. I know that we're just used to this now, but this was not a normal thing in public dialogue. I think maybe it starts with Bill Clinton. Maybe that's when the old white man became susceptible to any number of charges. I think if you're an old white guy and you run for political office at this time, the odds that you're not going to be accused of some kind of sexual assault are low. So what's going on with Kamala as vice president? Well, as vice president, I think it's fair to say she's been whisked away to the sidelines. And it's very obvious that, you know, she was put in charge of immigration and her policies or whatever oversight she was supposed to put into immigration just failed. There's no other way of putting it. How bad is this issue? Well, it seems like illegal border crossings jumped from 485,000 before her tenure as the so-called border czar to about 2.5 million. But there's some interesting facts even in this. If you look at what she actually did, it's also true that she had a plan that focused on improving the quality of life for those living in countries like, you know, Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala. The three countries showed significant drops in annual migration from more than 700,000 arrests on the border in 2021 to fewer than 500,000 in 2023. It's actually an interesting strategy. Maybe there's a way to do it. For now, all you can say is that it failed to produce the political goals that centrists and even a lot of Democrats really wanted from her. Now, Harris has a few things that are going for her, and these aren't, you know, the positives and negatives of her as a candidate, but this is some stuff that goes for her that could portend and presage a possible successful campaign. The first thing is that she's a Democrat. And most people in this country typically choose the Democratic nominee for president over the Republican nominee, basically always. With the solo exception of 2004, in every presidential election since 1992, the Democratic nominee has won the popular vote. Biden beat Donald Trump by 7 million votes in 2020. That trend is likely to continue because since 2020, about 16 million young people have now become eligible to vote, and 12 million people, most of them older, have died, and they tend to vote Democrat. Now, these dynamics across sexes are probably more complicated, and I'm sure that there are many in the Democratic Party who are aware of this, but in 2016, Hillary Clinton loses to Trump by 11 points among male voters. In 2020, Joe Biden ran about even with Trump among men. Here's the one possible saving grace. Awareness of who Kamala Harris actually is relatively low. It's around 65 to 70% most of these polls, people who actually know who she is. So if I was going to strongman this case, I would say that Kamala Harris has a radical opportunity to present herself to the American people as the alternative to Donald Trump. What she's done in the past has been to mainly identify herself as a relatively radical leftist and has alluded to many of the policies that centrists find unattractive, Republicans find unattractive, and plenty of Democrats find unattractive. She will have to make a very strong case for herself in order to scope out some of this centrist vote that is probably feeling pretty queasy right now. There is that opportunity, though. We will have to see if that is what she truly does. Thank you for joining me on this episode of the Thoughtful Discuss podcast.